I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. What happened during the genocide in Rwanda 20 years ago is well documented, but it remains hard to comprehend. At least 800,000 people slaughtered in a very personal killing frenzy that lasted for 100 days. How can any of us who weren't there even imagine what that was like? We can try to, perhaps, by listening to just one family's story. Esther Mujeweo and her three daughters lost more than 100 members of their extended family during the genocide. Esther's oldest daughter, Anna, was only 6 when it began.
I remember how we left the house and went to hide in the school where my father used to teach.
Anna and the other kids hiding in the school played cards. She says at first it seemed fun, almost like summer camp. But then everyone at the school was rounded up by Hutu militiamen.
We're all in a big room, and they came and said men and put the men on one side and the women and children on the other side.
The men, including Anna's father, were taken outside. Those inside heard gunshots. Miles away, the children's bedridden grandmother was murdered. Their grandfather, too, and their aunts and uncles. Even the little cousins they used to play with were killed. Somehow, Esther and her daughters managed to leave Rwanda, eventually finding safety in neighboring Uganda. Months later, when the genocide had finally ended, they returned to their Kigali neighborhood. That's where the world's Joyce Hackel met them in 1995.
It was an uphill walk to Esther's house in Kigali. I remember opening that dented gate 18 years ago and feeling uneasy. But inside was the warmth of a family. Lunch underway and kids competing for their mother's attention. One of the girls, I think it was Anna, sang me a song.
Anna, she has,
you see on the face, she looks more like me, or more like my family. But in the character and what she's doing, she's more her father.
A father Anna now struggles to remember. Esther says the evening the militia came into the school, Anna was quick to understand what was happening.
The night they shot her father, she was listening to everything. She heard everything, and she asked me, "Is it daddy they are shooting?" Yeah, and I told her, "Yes, it is your father they are shooting."
Esther later learned she'd grown up with some of the killers of her family. They'd been guests at her wedding. As we sat on the couch together, she paged through the photos in her wedding album.
This is an uncle of that my father is killed. Now, let me show the killers. You see, this one he is among the killers. Everybody in my village, the killers and those who they killed. And we were sharing, and we were drinking together, and we were dancing together. Everybody was there.
After that visit to Esther's home in 1995, I lost touch with her. Until I found her online and gave her a call last month.
Yeah, hello, Joyce. No, I'm happy to reconnect, Joyce.
In the years since we'd met, Esther had married a German citizen. She and the girls moved to a small town outside Dusseldorf in 1999. Esther now works as a psychotherapist, counseling refugees, mainly from Africa.
We are working with people who have been through the horror.
Esther's focused on others, but as for her own trauma,
it is a little bit like, when is it going to finish, my God? When is it going to finish? Because there is not a single day when we don't talk about genocide.
Her three girls are all in their 20s now and living in Berlin. Amelia, the middle daughter, says the family never stopped talking about 1994.
We're very lucky that Mom actually, even if it pissed us off sometimes, that it was always present. So the whole time while growing up, we were actually processing it.
Though Esther left Rwanda, she made regular visits back, determined to find the remains of her family. In 2005, she came face to face with those who killed her sister, Stephanie, and Stephanie's children.
It was surrealistic. It was really, you think, are we dreaming? They deny everything. They were also lying to us, not telling us. We opened so many holes thinking that this is where they are. So it was a very, very painful experience. But again, we have no choice. We have to pass through that to know where are the bodies so that at least we can bury them.
It was common during Rwanda's genocide for the killers to throw victims' bodies into pit latrines. Stephanie's neighbors didn't seem willing to admit to doing that.
Finally, somebody accepted to tell us in which latrine they have put them. We get them out, and we were really lucky. We could be sure that they are, because we found out Stephanie's small bag, and in the bag there was the ID card, the identity card was still okay because it was plasticized. Yeah, so at least we were sure that now we have get them out of the latrine, and we gave them a proper barrier, human barrier.
Rwanda's leaders have called on genocide survivors to forgive the killers. Esther questions that.
What is forgiveness? Forgive who? Who have asked me forgiveness? There is one man, the one who told us actually where they have dumped Stephanie and their children, one of the killers. And he said, if you can forgive me, you forgive me. If you can't, I will understand it. That man, Pierre, I gave him his forgiveness. First, he asked it, but also he helped. He helped us at least to find the bodies and bury our people. But for the others, those who were with him, they were just laughing. They were laughing.
Esther says finding her sister's remains gave her some relief. But learning her husband's story brought more pain. For years, the family thought they'd heard the gunshot that killed him.
Later on, a long, long time after, we discovered that when we heard the shooting, it was a man who tried to escape from the group of my husband, and then they were shooting him. The killers said they are tired, they don't want to work again, but they were afraid that they will run away like the one they have been shooting. So they cut the feet and let them bleed until the morning. They came to finish everybody, but they made sure that night and they can't move.
Yeah, it was shocking.
Esther's daughter, Amelia, says she didn't learn the story of how her father actually died until she got the courage to read a memoir her mother had written.
I stopped at that part and didn't read it for years, and I just finished it last summer, almost 10 years later.
Esther hasn't given up on the idea of trying to find the man who killed her husband.
I'm still trying to put things together. Now you hear something. Last time I have heard about one of the people who was killing in our place. He's now free in Belgium. So I was wondering, am I going to make research and try to find? Then the next day I'm tired and I don't want to go into it. Because from the experience of what was going on with my sister, with Stephanie, they can hurt you so much.
20 years after, I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't want to go there anymore.
Anna's certain she doesn't want to try to find her father's killers.
I don't want to know the person behind it. I'd much rather save it in my head as just the monsters that did it, and not a real person at all, with a story and a family probably and stuff like that. I don't want to go there.
Anna's sister, Amelia, says the genocide is something she'd like to put behind her. At the same time, she admits it's deeply part of her biography. She and her sister still visit Rwanda. They say they can imagine their mother moving back there one day. As for Esther, she says she's found some sort of reconciliation.
I lost a lot of trust in people, in human beings, in colleagues, in friends, in neighbors. But I can't live all the time without trust. You can't live. You will never be happy if you don't trust anybody. So we have to learn again to trust. Yeah, reconcile yourself, your life. Come to the point where you say, yeah, this life is worth it and I have the right to live again. But reconciliation between victims and perpetrator, it is too much to ask.
For The World, I'm Joyce Hackle.